You are listening to The Grandest Tour by The Cycling Podcast. Brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore, and tonight I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Lizzie Banks. Also known as Lizzie Banks. Hello, Lizzie.
Hi, everybody. Nice to meet you.
We're not taking any chances with you tonight, Lizzie.
Apologies to everybody for my terrible behaviour yesterday, but I was just
carried away.
So excited and so wrapped up in the race that I got very carried away.
Well, we ordered Lizzie to wash her mouth out with soap today. She's done that just in time for tonight's podcast, our final podcast from the 2020. Had to think about that. Giro d'Italia.
Hang on, just on that, Rich. Yes. The bleeper machine wasn't working, was it? That was a problem.
Our bleeper operator had the night off, didn't they?
Yeah, we've had a few messages today, but interestingly, no one has ever complained about Francois's catchphrase, which he says liberally and repeatedly.
And what's that again, Lionel?
Well, I'm too frightened now to say it. We'll have to wait till Francois's back on Tuesday.
That is an interesting point. Yes, but. Anyway, I don't think any of us will need to do any swearing tonight. It wasn't just Lizzie last night. I think James Knox as well dropped a bomb in his audio diary. We'll be hearing from James again tonight. We'll be hearing from Nick Schultz at a very eventful day at the Vuelta a España. You know, finally it bursts into life. I say finally, it's been crackling away, hasn't it? But today was quite a stage at the Vuelta. We'll be hearing from Daniel Freeb as well at the Vuelta, but we're going to be focusing a lot, obviously, and in the first part, on what happened in Milan today with the final time trial into Milan, deciding the Giro. Jai Hindley and Theo Gegenhardt level on time going into the stage, of course. And, well, have you got the headlines from the day, Lionel?
Well, I have. I'll try to sum it up as succinctly as possible. As you say, Rich, incredible stages in both Italy and Spain for different reasons. And it all worked out pretty well for Ineos Grenadiers in both races, didn't it? Because Theo Gegenhardt clinched his first Grand Tour victory and Richard Carapaz moved into the red jersey in the Vuelta. I was reflecting on this yesterday, or rather this morning, having recorded the podcast yesterday, how extraordinary it was that after 85 hours of racing, Theo Gegenhardt and Jai Hindley were both tied on time. The way the
especially,
time bonuses sorry, worked
Lionel,
out.
But especially in a Grand Tour with so much time trialling. You know?
Absolutely, yeah. And the way the time bonuses worked out in yesterday's stage alone, I mean, it was almost a fluke, really, wasn't it? That they were split by just fractions of a second overall after counting back the previous time trial stage times. So, as it turned out, it was a pretty convincing win for Theo Gegenhardt in the time trial over Jai Hindley in the race between the two of them. The stage itself was won by Filippo Ganna, also of Ineos, of course, who completed a clean sweep of the time trials in this Giro. He won on the opening day, he won the long time trial in the middle and again today, and of course he added a road stage too to take his tally to four. Ineos won seven in all. That's a third of the stages in the race, because Theo Gegenhardt won a couple and Jonathan Narvaez also won a stage before crashing out of the race on the day that went to Piancavallo. Anyway, Ganna beat the time of Victor Campenaerts by 32 seconds. Campenaerts was challenged by Rowan Dennis, but his time had stood firm. They were split by only a fraction of a second as well. So from pretty early on, it was obvious that Ganna had won the stage. And then it was really all eyes on Gegenhardt and Jai Hindley. And, well, from the first updates out on the road, we knew that Gegenhardt was up by a handful of seconds and then a couple of handfuls of seconds. And, well, you get the idea. It was 39 seconds by the finish. Nevertheless, a very good ride by Jai Hindley. in the circumstances. He lost the pink jersey to Theo Gegenhardt, who hadn't even pulled it on at any stage in the race. And that's the first time that that has happened in the Giro. Wilco Kelderman secured third overall. But the other notable ride of the day was by the longtime race leader, Joao Almeida, who was fourth on the stage to move up to fourth overall, bumping Pao Bilbao down a place. Should recap the other jerseys as well. Arnaud Demar won the points competition. Ruben Guerrero won the King of the Mountains. And Gegenhardt took the white jersey. Meanwhile, over in Spain, it was a filthy, wet, cold day to Formigal, which replaced the planned Tourmalet stage, and a big break of 23 riders got clear. It was packed with climbers, and then we saw the Izaguirre brothers do a sort of long Madison effort, because Gorka, the older of the two brothers, went from a long way out, and after he was caught, Jon Izaguirre went clear and held on to win the stage, his first Vuelta stage, which completes a set of stages in the three Grand Tours. Mike Woods of EF Pro Cycling outsprinted Rui Costa for second place. And behind all that, there was a big shake-up in the overall, because Primoz Roglic, who was the race leader this morning and who had a mechanical problem earlier in the stage, faltered on the final climb when, among others, Hugh Carthy and Richard Carapaz went on the offensive. Dan Martin was one of the other riders who was distanced a bit. So tonight, Carapaz is in red and Hugh Carthy is up to second place, 18 seconds behind Carapaz. Then it's Martin, Roglic and Mas, and those five are looking pretty good. The race has a rest day tomorrow.
And at Paris-Roubaix, Wout van Aert and Mathieu van der Poel got away in the Forest of Arenberg and sprinted out in the Velodrome, and it was a dead heat. So they share the title. And in the women's race, inaugural women's race, Lizzie Banks
was thrilled to take brackets, the victory.
No team took a fantastic solo win. Well done, Lizzie.
Lizzie Banks riding independently.
All in black, yeah. No, shame. Paris-Roubaix should have been on today. It wasn't. I'm up staying by the seaside, actually, not far from that area. And I was out riding my bike today and it was chucking it down. I was almost going to.
Well,
I
probably would have definitely won if it was chucking it down then.
It was chucking it down with the rain, so it might have been an interesting Paris-Roubaix, but we've got that to look forward to in April.
You are listening to The Grandest Tour by the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWalker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWalker. If you run a business, find out more at iwoca.co.uk. iwoca.co.uk.
Thank you very much indeed to iWoca, our title sponsor. We're very grateful to them for their support. And if you run a small business or would like to know what iWoca might be able to do for you in the form of a loan to help develop your business, go to iwoca.co.uk. Also check out iWalker's reviews on Trustpilot. They have a very high rating lots and lots of reviews there. And a lot of people praise iWalker for the fact that they speak to real people when they contact them about their business. So thanks to iWalker. Well, today's stage, I mean, huge anticipation, excitement and so on. Never been two riders tied on time going into the final stage, and a time trial, of course, at that. Dare I say it, though, that in the end, it was slightly anticlimactic in the sense that, you know, from very early on in the race, we knew that Gegenhardt was ahead, and it was a, you know, 15-kilometer, not very technical time trial. It was difficult to see anything changing over the rest of the race. So from that point of view, from a suspense and drama point of view, it was a slightly anticlimactic, the stage itself, I thought.
It was no Tour de France time trial, let's put it like that. But I mean, it was still exciting. In the first few kilometres, it was short enough that it was exciting. So at least we didn't have to watch a 40-minute time trial where we knew what was going to happen in the outcome. In the first few kilometres, Eurosport had had them equal at zero, or well, the first few kilometres after Jai Hindley had actually started. But then, yeah, it became clear very quickly that Tao had the upper hand. But still, you know, coming into a city, you've got oil on the road, and we hadn't seen any crashes before, but every time we took a corner, I was holding my breath. So there was some suspense, but no Tour de France time trial.
Yeah, I mean, that was the only chance of suspense, really, was a crash. And to be perfectly honest, that's not really the sort of drama that we would have wanted to decide the Giro. You wanted the legs to decide it, well, and the head as well, of course. I mean, if you remember back to when Denis Menchov fell off right towards the end of the final time trial in, what year would that have been, Rich? 2009? I mean, his victory was not really in doubt at that stage, but it's that kind of false drama that you know you don't really want to see the race come down to the final time trial and then have it settled by misfortune. So yeah, it was all about the anticipation, wasn't it? And I don't think it was as much of a given in advance as it turned out. You know, 39 seconds in 15.7 kilometres is well, it's pretty much you know, comprehensive, isn't it? It's a you know, there's daylight between them and some, but in the, you know, the half hour, the hour leading up to it, and having seen how well Ganna had gone round, and you know, watching some of the other GC riders set off, there was that moment of doubt, the thought that although Theo Gegenhardt was probably the favourite for the time trial, that, you know, anything could happen. If he didn't get out of the start gate right, and it didn't settle down right, and he didn't get into his rhythm, you know, Jai Hindley would have been aware of that early on, and perhaps things could have gone the other way. But it was all about getting the upper hand, really, wasn't it? I mean, I'm assuming that even had one of them gone out just a bit too hard, they were in 15.7 kilometres. Is there time to kind of, you know, correct and just calm down a second? It's not like going too deep too early and still having 30 kilometers to go. You know,
we're all experts on this, aren't we? Because we've probably, most of us have ridden a 10 mile time trial, 10 mile fairly flat time trial.
I mean,
yeah, I think that's the thing with a 17, 18 minute effort. You can go out really, really hard and cling on.
Yeah. If you it's do not that always in a 17, 18 minute effort for all of us.
Extremely generous of you, Lizzie. if you could perhaps add about 12.
I'm talking specifically about this time trial, not about our minute own effort. 10 minute efforts.
But, I mean, one thing I would say, and this goes right back to Palermo when Daniel and I were there talking about the time trial there, which was run off in pretty atrocious conditions and an unusual time trial, but he did say that time trials, any length of time trials, are a great sort of indication of form. And I think this one ran to form. You know, Kelderman maybe very slightly below par, Gegenhardt very slightly above par for him, and Jai Hindley kind of on par, I thought, in terms of their individual performances. And so at the end of it all, and, you know, the debate about whether Jai Hindley should have waited for Wilco Kelderman on the Stelvio, still rumbling on my Twitter feed. But, you know, I think Theo Gegenhardt is a deserving winner of those three, if only for the fact that he seemed in the last few days to be the freshest and the strongest. And I think today kind of confirmed that.
Well, one rider that did have a great time trial and definitely performed above par, I would say, was Almeida. And I think he really, like, you know, he took on this race like he's taken on every single day of the whole Giro, and he wanted to get that spot up on GC, and he rode an absolute blinder. He was actually fourth overall on the stage, and then moved up to fourth on GC, and it was such a deserving ride by him. And it's just, yeah, I mean, he's really brought the whole Giro alive, and I think it's a great sign of things to come, and I hope that he will get the opportunity in the future. And I think being on a team that doesn't have a lot of GC leaders, I think that he will get that opportunity. It's a good thing that he's not on Ineos, because they're going to be in a bit of a pickle for the next few years.
Yeah, I mean, Almeida, since losing the pink jersey, I mean, you couldn't give him any more credit, because, you know, he was aggressive in trying to sort of bump himself back up the GC a bit, and perhaps thought there was an outside chance of the podium on the basis that Kelderman was clearly fading a bit. And then to pull out that performance today, I mean, that's from Well, from A to Z, he's had a fantastic Giro right from the very start back in Palermo. But just on Ineos, I mean, really, you have to give them credit as well for turning round a Giro that could have just disappeared down the gurgler after Geraint Thomas crashed out on stage three. They came roaring back. I mean, obviously, they'd already had some success on the first day with Filippo Ganna, and, you know, Ganna had the pink jersey. But then to really seize the initiative and go out and look for stage wins and getting in breaks on a lot of occasions as well. They really responded very well. And then the story of the second half of the race is just the way that Theo Gegenhardt has just moved up and up and up. And in terms of sort of judging a run at it over 3 weeks, you can't really get it much more precise than taking the leader's jersey and putting it on for the first time on the final podium.
I mean, did...
Yeah, sorry. I was going to say, Dave Brailsford was interviewed straight after the stage. And, you know, he said that they just said, oh, you know, well, we'll take the opportunities, we'll see as they come. And it wasn't that early that they said to Theo, you know, you go for the GC. And they kind of, you know, floated the idea and kept it really relaxed. And then, yeah, it seemed like that attitude of like, we'll try, but we'll see what happens. And then he said that he really grew into the role as the days went on. And from a viewing point of view, it was definitely clear to see that that's what was happening. And obviously that kind of no pressure, let's get what we can. The riders obviously respond really well to that. And actually Brailsford also said, you know, we've ridden grand tours in a kind of... you know, all the riders on the front tempo, but it's actually really boring and it's way more fun to race like this. So maybe we're gonna see Ineos changing their style of racing. I really hope so, because it's obviously working for them. I mean, one third of all stage wins is pretty phenomenal. And of course the overall and the white jersey.
Brailsford's interview was, and the team classification as well, actually. Brailsford's interview was interesting. I mean, he appeared almost giddy. We'll try and get him on the podcast in the next couple of days when he's maybe calmed down a bit. But he was ecstatic. I've never seen him like that, actually. And he did make an interesting point, I thought. He said that Ganna's stage win, road win on stage five when he won, that filthy day up to Camigliatello Silano, I was there. It was a long, kind of grimy stage. Terrible weather. Thomas de Gendt was up the road, and Ganna won that stage on his own. And Brailsford said that was really the catalyst for what's happened here for that team and for Theo Gegenhardt, because it was a sort of unexpected win. And he used the word inspiring. It inspired Gegenhardt and everybody else on the team. And it helped, I think, to create a sense of momentum. And we saw, you know, Ben Swift having a go on multiple days, and obviously then Gegenhardt finding in the last few days that his legs were just great. And I'm looking at that stage, and you know, you look down the list behind, because it was a tough day for the GC riders as well. And it was kind of Almeida, Kelderman, Lewis Hamilton, Jai Hindley sort of led in the GC riders. Gegenhardt was a bit further down. Just underlines what I said last night, that had his team not pulled out, I think Lewis Hamilton would have probably been on the podium as well. A trio of 24-year-olds. It was interesting. And I think, you know, what happened with Theo Gegenhardt in the end maybe did owe quite a lot to the team and the success of someone like Ganna.
Yeah, I mean, I always say that success breeds success, and I think that that's really important, and also the team culture and the atmosphere within a team. And it's been really, really clear from kind of, you know, Theo trolling Rowan Dennis during interviews, and just they just get on really well, it seems, from the outside, and they seem to be really happy and having a lot of fun. And being happy is so important. And Rowan Dennis said, you know, on stage 20, what was the key? And he said, you know, I was just happy. I was just enjoying myself. I was having fun. And you can go so, so deep for a teammate when you're having fun. It's actually easier to go deep for a teammate than it is to go deep for yourself sometimes, because if you're in a position where you're going for a result, then sometimes you don't want to give it all because you don't want to risk blowing up and then blowing the chance of the result. But if you're riding for a teammate, you can go to the red and you can go beyond it, and then you can come back again and again and again, because you know that you have just got to give everything until you die. And that is what happened with Dennis. And we've just seen time and time again that because of that, and because they're happy, it's kind of, yeah, breeding more success within the team, and then obviously led to this incredible win.
What comes
win.
First, though, Lizzie, that kind of positive atmosphere, or the wins? Does the positive atmosphere, is that created through the success, or is it the other way around?
It's definitely a mix. The personalities on the team are so important and are so key. And if you've got a number of personalities that lift the team and create this spirit within the team, then that is going to breed success, whatever happens, because yeah, you're going to have this positive atmosphere. Of course, then when you get that success, then that lifts the team again. And over in the Vuelta, people talked about, you know, people were so horrible about Froome when he got dropped on the first stage. And I was thinking, you know, give him a break, because look where he's come from. He's had the most horrific injury. And then other people are saying, well, you know, they probably brought Froome because they knew that he wasn't fit enough, but just having him on the team lifts the whole team, because he's a great tactician. He is, yeah, one of the greatest of all time in terms of Grand Tour wins. And he knows, yeah, he just knows what to do. And having a rider like that on the team can be so valuable to the atmosphere of the team. And when you've got a good atmosphere, then, you know, the results just kind of come naturally sometimes.
Just on Brailsford's comments, Rich, I mean, I do sometimes think he's, if he was to have a podcast of his own, it would be called Revisionist Histories, with the name of a very, very,
I think that title's already taken.
Yeah, it's already taken, isn't it? But he does sort of
reverse engineering podcast.
Yeah, he's the sort of retrofit explanations. He's kind of made a bit of a habit of that in recent years. You know, sort of makes out it was all part of the plan in the first place. And I just don't think bike racing, it's too random for that. There's too many variables, too many factors. And certainly in the past, you know, when I've sort of criticised him for riding in one way, you know, he's dismissed that criticism, saying, you know, well, our job's to win the race. And you know, if we win the race by playing to our strength, well, that's that. But this really
Well, maybe he's finally learned that there's more than one way to win a bike race.
Well, of course
sounds
there is,
like
yeah.
It. Sounds like that's out the window now.
Well, it won't
ride
be, though,
in
will
a completely
it?
Different way.
It won't be. They have shown in this race certainly a lot more adaptability to the circumstances. And I think that is a good point you made there, Lizzie, about not just sort of thrusting Theo Gegenhardt into, right, you are now Geraint Thomas in this team, and you've got to, you know, you've got to basically follow all the right wheels. And it was certainly from the perspective of watching the race, he was quiet initially, and then just grew into things, and then tested his legs on those few days when he looked quite lively. And then, of course, when it really mattered, he was one of the key players. It was an impressive win, but not one that you really saw coming until, I think, the Stelvio day.
Absolutely. Just a word on Theo. I mean, we have followed his progress for a long time, really almost the lifespan of the podcast. We sat down with him in a pub by Liverpool Street Station in London in the winter of 2013, and had a long chat with him then about you know, where he was up to then. He was obviously just 18, he'd just left school, just done his exams, and he was heading off to Girona. And that was really the start of his journey. We caught up with him at length again a year later. That first podcast it's a difficult listen because of the clanking cutlery. We weren't as high tech then as we are now. He says, but we've caught up with him a lot over the years, and you know, it's been fascinating to follow his progress. But even back then, he always struck me as unusually serious about, you know, wanting to become a great cyclist, or just, I'm not even sure, and I think he said this in interviews as well, that he has never really sort of dreamt of winning the Tour de France, but more of just being there. And Bradley Wiggins made this point in commentary a few times today that, you know, he's one of us. I think I got the impression I always had from him is a deep love and almost reverence for the sport and a real desire to be part of it. And he's always been very willing at Team Sky and Team Ineos to be a very good teammate to people. I mean, he had this very close bond with Egan Bernal, you know, in the first year or so of Bernal's career with that team. And it almost seemed like, and I spoke to his partner, Hannah Barnes, about this, that she was worried at one point that he was too willing to be the great teammate, and perhaps had lost sight of his own ambitions, maybe slightly along the way. I also listened again today to Mitch Docker's interview with him, which is absolutely fantastic. We released that earlier this year, an edited version, but go back and have a listen to that just for a real sort of rounded view of where he came from, how he got into racing, the track racing that he did at Herne Hill. And Theo describes very well those experiences and how much he enjoyed them, and you know, and also why he decided not to turn pro with Team Sky when they first offered him a contract. He stayed another year as an under-23 rider. I was listening to that thinking, nowadays that would maybe be a harder thing to do because we're seeing, you know, 20, 21, 22-year-old riders not just turn professional but actually win at the highest level. But he took an extra year and really wanted to make sure everything was right. Wanted to win some races before turning pro. So yeah, there's a lot in the archive there to, if you want to go back and, you know, understand a bit more about Theo Gegenhart and where he's come from, search for Theo Gegenhart in the search bar at thecyclingpodcast.com.
Well, I'll put links to those three episodes you mentioned, Richard, in today's show notes.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science and Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast. If you want 25% off your Science and Sport products, go to scienceandsport.com and enter the code SISCP25. SISCP25. Now, we've had six riders, keeping audio diaries for us at the Giro d'Italia. We've also got some riders keeping audio diaries at the Vuelta a España. You're going to hear more from them in the next couple of weeks. But James Knox, we've been hearing from him regularly, rides for Deceuninck Quick-Step, finished 14th on GC. I mean, a very decent ride from him, you know, as an individual, but his main role during the race was helping his Portuguese teammate, João Almeida, of course. Here's James's final dispatch from the Giro d'Italia.
It's the final entry. I'm done. Giro's over. British winner. Not the one anyone was expecting, but yeah, Teo's done pretty unbelievable performance in the last 3 weeks. Him and Jai, big head-to-head. And big showdown, wow. I guess Teo was expected to put him away in the TT, but a time trial like this, I can't imagine, you know. Both guys must have been exhausted. All the stress, thinking about everything last night, how they slept, riding around the course this morning. There's a lot more going into it than just going hard for 17, 18 minutes, whatever it was for those guys today. So, yeah, chapeau to both of them. A deserved Giro 1 and 2. Strange feeling for me, actually. I enjoyed myself a bit too much yesterday. I had a lot to drink on the bus, celebrating like it was already over. So I woke up a bit, feeling a bit worse for wear this morning, a bit tired, a bit over it. So yeah, I sort of had to just get it done, to be honest. Didn't want to lose that 14th, so tried to psych myself up a bit. But yeah, it wasn't much fun, to be honest. Didn't really get going, but in the end did enough to hold my place and finished the Giro in a nice 14th position as well. It's also an unfortunate thing this year that we can't go out. So yeah, we had some pizza and everything ready for the riders at the end of the time trial. Obviously, huge relief and yeah, just Relief is the word, you know. Made it to the end. Can put the bike away for a month now. But it would be nice to go out and have a proper meal. Last year in Madrid, you know, we went out to a nice restaurant and then went to some bars and stuff. But not possible this year. So, yeah. Haven't really got anything planned for the off season either, as you can all imagine. Pretty hard to make any plans for the moment. Got team meetings in Belgium that were supposed to happen in 10 days, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure they'll go ahead either. So, yeah, that's my bit for the Giro. Thank you all for listening and supporting. It's been a very hard 3 weeks, emotionally and physically. And yeah, I'm ready for a break now. I'm ready to not think about cycling, not watch the Vuelta, and get fat, just get as fat as I can for at least a month and then get back to work. But anyway, cheers to everyone. Ciao.
Well, that was James Knox of the Koenig Quick Step. There'll be more of James and all the other diarists in our episode of Kilometer Zero, which is coming out tomorrow. Including James's interview on the bus with Scotland's Ali Hodge, his teammate and roommate, Alvaro Hodge, Colombian Scotsman. And well, a Scotsman has won the Giro today, Tail Gegenhart, a Scotsman in the Koenig Quick Step, sharing a room with James, and then tomorrow's Kilometre Zero. And somebody on Twitter pointed out to me that somebody who sounds like a Scotsman moved up to second overall at the Vuelta, because Hugh Carthy was called Hugh McCarthy on BBC News, apparently. Anyway, on back to the Giro. What are your other kind of what are your other reflections on the Giro at the end of the race, Lizzie? One point that Victor Campenaerts made in his interview after, well, he was in the hot seat today, and that one of our listeners made as well on our Facebook page, asking whether this rescheduled season has maybe favoured younger riders over older riders. I mean, we've seen younger riders really, really come to the fore. Is it because older riders are more in tune with the usual cycling year and their bodies are more kind of, you know, used to being in peak form in May or July or whenever, and maybe less adaptable to this requirement of being in peak form in October or into November if it's the Vuelta? Is there anything in that, do you think?
It's not something I have huge experience of, because even though I'm on the cusp of 30, it's only my end of my second European season, so I don't feel like I've really got into the same kind of body clock that somebody that's been cycling for 14 years would have done. But having said that, in the women's peloton, it's pretty common that you go into the world champs and then that is your final race. And that's at the end of December. And now our season is finishing at the Madrid Challenge, which is the women's race at the Vuelta. So that's finishing on the 8th of November. And that is a bit of an ask. And we heard the riders in the Giro saying that one thing that was really kind of playing with their heads and making them struggle a bit. And one of the reasons why they were finding this long stage that got shortened on Friday so challenging is because they're finding that they're waking up in the dark, they're getting back to the hotel and it's already dark. And it is one of those things that you get into this point of the year and your body just kind of begins to slow down a bit. And perhaps with the younger riders, they haven't got into that rhythm yet. And I also think that the lockdown itself will have had a massive impact, because everybody trained in such a different way. Perhaps the older riders kind of thought, oh, screw it, I'm just gonna sit back because we don't think there's going to be any racing. I don't want to train so much. I know Thibaut Pinot, he was famed for saying, I absolutely hate the turbo trainer, I'm not going to touch the turbo trainer. And he was living in France, and the restrictions meant that he wasn't allowed to go more than a kilometre from his house. So unless he was doing laps around the block, which I very much doubt, then his training wasn't going to be good quality. And obviously, we saw a not great performance in the Tour de France. And was it injury? Was it form? I don't know. But I do think that there is something in the way that riders responded to lockdown and the way that they trained in lockdown. And perhaps youth here gave the riders an advantage, because perhaps they were a bit able to bounce back mentally from it a bit better than the older riders. I mean, it's just a hypothesis, but I think it's definitely one that needs to be looked at, because we've just seen such a clear division here that we've not seen for, well, ever before, really, I would say.
And this is going to lag into...
Yeah.
This is going to lag into next year, it significantly, isn't it? Because normally riders would be wrapping up before now and would be taking their break and then thinking about getting back to some form of training when? Late November, December, training camp, you know, the first training camp, typically sort of early December, then another one just before Christmas, and then... you know, then the racing resumes and everyone's into the following season. Whereas what are the alternatives here? I mean, no one's particularly going to want to get straight back into it a matter of sort of 3-4 weeks after finishing the Vuelta, for example. So we're going to have an even more elongated end to the season and beginning to the next season. And teams might have to take that into account when they come to pick their squads for early season races. It could well have some far-reaching implications, this.
No, for sure. But I mean, the Australia races won't happen for certain. So that is a bit of a blessing in disguise, in that the riders will get a bit of a break, whereas otherwise some of them would have been expected to go to Australia. But yeah, I mean, I do think the effects of fatigue and the effects of overtraining, often you don't see them for a really, really long time. And I think that's something that's going to have a really interesting impact on the Vuelta, with quite a few of those riders having ridden the Tour de France. And they didn't really get a break between the Tour de France and the Vuelta. You know, they had to go to the World Championships. Primoz Roglic was at Liège-Bastogne-Liège as well. And, you know, you have to keep on top of that form. And obviously we'll talk about the Vuelta in a bit, but maybe that's one of the reasons that the cracks are beginning to show today. And I do think that some really weird things are going to happen, and I think that this year is going to be an exceptional year in terms of the results, and I don't think we're going to see a replication of these results that we've seen this year in future years, unless we have another very weird circumstance like we did this year. But hopefully that's not going to happen again.
Just before we move on, Rich, sorry, I just wanted to ask you guys a question. Do you know Theo Gegenhardt's contract situation for next season? I understand he is staying with Team Ineos Grenadiers, but nothing has been confirmed at the moment, certainly.
I mean, quite a few of their riders are out of contract, including Pavel Sivakov, and I understand, you know, he's agreed, and I think they've agreed new contracts with a lot of riders, but haven't announced them yet. I wouldn't be surprised if there's an announcement on this tomorrow. I think that you know, a few teams have got riders on extended contracts, and they haven't announced them yet because there's been so much racing going on. Ineos did announce 4 new signings, didn't they? And said that with that, their roster for next year was complete. So but then after that, I heard that Edvald Boasenhagen might be going back there. So there might still be a bit of flexibility. But, you know, I think that a lot of these riders who are out of contract have actually agreed and signed new contracts.
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, what usually happens is that the teams wait for the riders to do something good. And finally, Teo may manage to do something that was, you know, all right in terms of results.
But who knows? Maybe he'll be off to Sunweb.
Let's hope he had a Grand Tour winning clause in that contract somewhere, because yeah, if not, he's going to be a little bit underpaid.
Yeah.
But I mean, looking ahead, that they really have got some tricky decisions to make when it comes to selecting the teams for next year's Grand Tours, because you would imagine, having won the Giro, Theo Gegenhardt would be pretty desperate to make his debut at the Tour de France. But then you've got Bernal, Carapaz.
I'm sorry, Lionel, but I don't think, you know, he's going to be... Of course, he's going to want to make his debut at the Tour de France, but if he's going to get the opportunity to go to something else as a leader, say, if he got the opportunity to go to the Vuelta as a leader, and he now knows that he's capable of winning a Grand Tour, would he take that opportunity to go to the Vuelta as a leader instead of going to the Tour de France as a number 4-5 rider? You know, they've got so many that he's going to be so far down the pecking order. And yes, he's an incredible rider who's just won a Grand Tour, but look who else is on their roster. So he's just going to be absolutely fighting. So maybe it's better to go to one of the lesser, in inverted commas. Does he go back to the Giro because he's the defending champion?
I think he definitely wants to go to the Tour de France, and that's something he wants to tick off. And I think that would maybe even take priority. I mean, what I said earlier about him maybe sometimes being too willing to be a teammate. I'm not sure that will change. I think it'd be a bit like Geraint Thomas, who, you know, won the Tour de France, but then accepted a year later the sort of reverting back to the team role. Okay, he and Bernal were sort of joint leaders at the Tour de France, but when push came to shove, he didn't complain too much, and he seemed reasonably content to do that. And you know, had he gone to the Tour this year, I think he'd have gone in a team role too. And I think Tao would go to the Tour in that role. I guess the question, and this applies to Jai Hindley as well, is, you know, we're mentioning the peculiarities of the season. Maybe these will be anomalous results. Who knows whether these guys will kick on from this? I mean, Jai Hindley is one who, you know, he could go on and become a Grand Tour contender, or perhaps he won't. Perhaps it was just a very kind of strange set of circumstances that left him in this position this year. And I mean, I think one of the interesting things about this generation of riders is, you know, there's an awful lot of them, and it doesn't seem to me there's an awful lot to separate them. I mean, Sivakov's another one who, had he been at this race, he could conceivably have been in this position too. There are others as well. So Jai Hindley, I mean, a fantastic performance here, but in the end, he was let down a bit by his time trialling. And if he wants to win a Grand Tour, he's going to have to be a bit better at time trialling than that, I would think.
Morning, chaps, from the Vuelta, very cold Vuelta. I don't think I've ever seen riders as cold as they were at the finish today. I think, well, there was one interview given in the mix zone today, and that was the ever reliable, ever loyal Nicholas Egg, the Trek Segafredo Danish rider. The Danish riders are incredibly diligent when it comes to satisfying the demands of their national broadcaster here at TV2. And they almost, they do invariably stop. As soon as they come over the line, they stop at the Danish TV's booth to give interviews. But today, even Michael Morkø, who I don't think I've ever seen refuse an interview with Danish TV, he just shook his head. His teeth were chattering, and he headed straight onto the bus. But Nicholas Egg gave the only interview of any rider in the mix zone. Certainly after the riders came over the line, there were a couple, Primoz Roglic, who I think he went to anti-doping and got warmed up. And about half an hour later, he did stop by and he told us what happened today. And there were more issues with the Dutch team. I still refer to Sunweb as a Dutch team anyway. And a rain cape. Rog's issue today was that he couldn't get his rain cape or rain jacket zipped up on the top of the penultimate climb. And consequently fell way back in the group. And at the same time, Jumbo-Visma weren't sure whether this was because Roglic was experiencing difficulties, but at the same time, Ineos Grenadiers went to the front, started pulling very hard with Andre Amador. And that put Roglic in some difficulty. He had to use a couple of teammates, including Sepp Kuss, to bring him back up as close as he could to the front of the bunch. And at that point, the race was really on. And the attacks were going off the front. And it was really a battle to limit his losses there for Roglic. So I think he lost about 40 seconds in the end. Carapaz takes the red jersey, looking very strong. I must say he's also looking very focused in interviews. Absolutely no messing, no pleasantries whatsoever. And he looks like a man with a very well-defined plan to win this Vuelta. So, quite impressive and, shudderingly impressive, I would say, the way he's looked so far. Anyway, of course, I had one eye on the Giro and Theo Gegenhardt's victory. Can't help myself thinking back to Rich when we were in Sicily and in Enna in particular, and the start of that day. What seemed very notable at the time was very notable at the time for Geraint Thomas crashing. And the first inkling we had that something was amiss in the Ineos team that day was, well, we saw Theo hurtling down the same descent, so in the neutralised zone or just after, was it in the neutralised zone or a few hundred metres after the start of the stage. Theo was hurtling down a descent and looking frantically over his shoulder, looking for his team car, I think trying to alert the team car to Geraint Thomas's crash. And you would never have suspected at that point, and you wouldn't have suspected later that day either, when Tao lost time at Etna, that he was even going to play any role in general classification. And and look what has materialized over the past 2 or 3 weeks. First ginger haired Giro d'Italia champion, I think. Maybe second ginger haired Grand Tour champion after Jan Ulrich, but we'll check that. And I will give a definitive answer on that over the next couple of days.
Well, admirable restraint from Daniel there, not to mention that Theo Gegenhardt is, I think, the second Arsenal fan to win a Grand Tour after Geraint Thomas. Bound to be corrected on that. There's probably somebody else, but it doesn't leap to mind. But
What about the claim about the first ginger-haired Giro winner?
Peter Winnan never won a Grand Tour, did he?
Poor old Stephen Kreiswick went so close, didn't he?
Of course.
He'll be gutted to have missed out on that.
I mean, is there much correlation between hair colour and Grand Tour success? I'm not sure.
Clearly there is.
But
on the evidence is staring in the face, Lionel.
I'll tell you who's not Dale doing who's the first. Not doing well in modern cycling is bald riders.
No, it's they were quite big in the 90s, weren't they?
Yeah, interesting that.
Yeah, well, older cyclists did quite well in the 90s. anyway, Daniel kept us up to date with put us up to date with the Vuelta there, and what a miserable looking day it was in Spain, and the rain doesn't clearly just fall on the plain in Spain, because it was horrible, wasn't it? And it looked cold, and we saw that at the Giro as well. And when we saw it at the Giro, there were a lot of questions about whether we'd even make it to Milan, because there were these high mountain stages in the final week. I mean, we should reflect, as we did at the Tour, on the fact that the Giro did make it to Milan, and you know everything that went into making that happen, including good luck, was quite remarkable, really. The Vuelta, I'm sure the same questions will continue to be asked. We're heading into November, but today looked horrible, and it took a real toll on the race. And as Daniel said, we saw yet again the issue of riders struggling to put on their rainwear, and we had a great insight into that particular issue from Joe Dombrowski when the Sunweb riders had the problem on the Stelvio stage. But were you surprised, Lizzie, to see Roglic lose a bit of time? He's normally so dependable, so consistent. It's one of the few times I've seen him struggle. Was it just the weather, do you think, or is something else going on there?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Like we were saying before, the effect of racing at this point in the season off the back of a Tour de France is really just so unknown. And it's so weird because he just has been so infallible in every single every single time we've seen him, he's been absolutely infallible. And here, you know, finally losing quite a bit of time. Was it 45 seconds, I think, he lost to Hugh Carthy and Carapaz? And it was a big gap. And then even when he was in that chasing group behind, he was even struggling to hold the wheels of the riders in that chasing group. So, yeah, I mean, hopefully it's just a one-off, and hopefully it was the cold or something like that. The other thing about the cold is that, you know, we'll see if that affects them in the coming days, because they do have a weakened immune system, especially they've done so much this season. It's so late. They're really tired. Let's hope that they manage to steer clear of viruses and don't get sick, because that's something that can have a really, really bad effect in a long race like this.
Well, one of our diarists, Mitch Docker, the host of Life in the Peloton, sent a dispatch a night or so ago just talking about how tough the opening few stages of the Vuelta had been.
G'day, guys. I haven't checked in for a few days, but that's because it's been pretty hard. I'm not going to complain. It looks like the boys across here at the Giro have got certainly a hard thing going on there. Third week, epic stages and some bad weather rolling in. But we've had a hard kickstart here at the Vuelta. And it really does feel, like I said in the first one, that we're about 5, 6, 7 days deep. You know, it doesn't feel like we've only just had four stages. Is it four stages? Yeah, four stages. It feels like the rest day is going to be in its normal place after nine stages, you know, and not after six. But we had a bit of good news. I guess you could call it good news for riders, depending which rider you are, that the Tour of Malay stage got changed. And for me, it was not necessarily the Tour of Malay. It was the uphill start of that day, which was looking frightening for me. Today in the race was a sort of a nice day. It potentially could have been a really tough day, like that stage in the Vuelta last year that was crosswind all day. The wind just died down, which is uncharacteristic for this area. And we just had a fast tailwind stage. Certainly stressful, but it never really split. A nice sprint. And I think everyone just enjoyed it. Coming up for a big weekend and a hard first 3 days, it was just a nice little breather.
Well, interesting there, Mitch, saying that coming up to six Vuelta stages has felt like the normal nine that you'd have before the first rest day. And with the amount of racing that Roglic has done in a relatively short period of time, you know, when things catch up with you, I guess they can catch up with you pretty much instantaneously. And when the tank suddenly empties, the tank suddenly empties.
Well, let's hear from another of our Vuelta diarists, Nick Schultz of Mitchelton Scott. His team leader, Esteban Chavez, had an okay day today, did he? A bit better? He finished sort of just around about Roglic. So he looked good at one point, and he's still up there overall. Chavez in the top 10, he's eighth. And Nick Schultz's main job is to support him. Here's what he said, and we can hear, I think, the rain hitting off the roof of the bus as he's speaking.
Stage six. Really, really tough day out there today. We had some really bad weather to contend with. A lot of rain, freezing temperatures. That made for a very tough day. As a lot of you probably know, the stage got changed due to some restrictions in France, so we didn't end up doing the stage that was originally planned, finishing at the Tourmalet via the Orbisque. They did a stage that they'd used here in the past in 2016, and it was still quite solid. There were two sort of gradual climbs that weren't too bad, and then quite a long slog to the finish. But again, it wasn't super steep until the last 4K or so. A big break went down the road. We didn't have anyone represented, so we clocked on to looking after Esteban and Mikel. Basically, that involved today, you know, riding in good position, making sure they had all the clothing necessary, going back to the car, getting extra jackets, taking their old jackets back, making sure they had the right winter gloves, enough food, enough drinks. Basically to get them through the stage. My role again today was to stay with them for quite a while on the final climb, just in case there were any problems like we saw with Esteban the other day. Luckily that didn't eventuate, and Mikel and Esteban actually got amongst it and attacked with 3 or 4K to go to put some pressure on the other GC guys, and they did that, and they finished nicely, and Esteban's looking really good heading into the first rest day, which we're all looking forward to after today.
So that was Nick Schultz of Mitchelton Scott. We'll be hearing more from him as the Vuelta goes on, also from Nick Dlamini and Scott Davis, and they'll be featuring also in tomorrow's episode of Kilometre Zero, powered by Zwift. How was your Zwift ride today, Lionel?
Well, it was good fun. Good turnout again. We had TV's Rob Hatch and one of our producers, Adam Bowie, along for the ride. But unfortunately, I forgot to select the option that keeps everyone together in one group. So,
You didn't drop everyone again, did you?
I dropped them.
Lionel.
I dropped them. I reverse dropped them. Yeah.
It's like the Giro. People going out the back rather than off the front.
It was a bit like that, yeah. There's some pretty strong riders who may or may not be lying about their weight. No,
did Jai Hindley wait for you?
No. He was otherwise occupied, I think, today.
Right. Oh, well, I'll hopefully join you on that ride. Maybe Lizzie will join it as well at some point. Lizzie, when you're back on your bike?
Yeah, I mean, I guess when I finally get back on my bike, I might be about the same speed of, as Lionel. Or maybe Richard.
Amazing. Oh,
I don't know how to take that, really.
Incredible trolling. I mean, three episodes in and already you've slotted right in with the trolling. Excellent. Just one very quick thing, Rich. In our newsletter on Friday, I did another one of our cheeky competitions to win one of our cycling podcast jerseys. The question was a toughie. Who did people think would win the Giro overall? Hundreds and hundreds of people entered, and about well over half, I didn't count exactly, but well over half the people picked Theo Gegenhardt, and I selected a winner at random from the Sean Kelly casquette, and a jersey will be winging its way to Andy Thorpe. Congratulations, Andy. I'll get that out in the post to you this week. If anyone else wants one of our cycling podcast jerseys, be quickish, because we are starting to run out in some of the sizes. Good availability in certainly medium and large, and small, medium, large, but some of the other sizes, extra small and extra large, are running out.
All you outliers, get your jerseys now. Well, that's about it for the Giro, I guess, although we are going to hear from our old friend Ciro Scognamiglio. He's obviously very busy tonight, works for Gazzetta dello Sport. And he's going to send us in his thoughts and reflections. But we'll play them in our Tuesday episode, which will be obviously mainly about the Vuelta. Will you be joining us again on Tuesday, Lizzie?
I will be joining you again next weekend on Friday for four more episodes.
Who's on Tuesday? Great. That's Who's right. on Tuesday, Lionel?
We have Francois for a couple of days, 3 days, Tuesday, Wednesday and Thursday, Francois Tomazo, then Lizzie again, and then I can't remember the final week of the Vuelta, but we'll have rotating round Lizzie, Francois and Ian Boswell, who'll be back from his fishing trip.
Yeah, Lionel's in charge of the rota, so as long as you're keeping on top of that. Well, that's all from the Giro for now. Thanks very much to you, Lizzie.
Thank you very much. I'm very much looking forward to a rest day. It's been an exhausting few days of watching bike racing and talking about bike racing.
And thank you, Lionel.
Thanks, Rich.